Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received, for good or for evil, in the superlative degree of comparison only. There were a king with a large jaw and a queen with a plain face on the throne of England. There were a king with a large jaw and a queen with a fair face on the throne of France. In both countries it was clearer than crystal to the lords of the state, preserves of loaves and fishes, that things in general were settled forever. It was the year of our Lord 1775.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Heck yeah. You know what? We were so right. I feel that we should take some credit, because way back when we talked about Bleak House, we mentioned that this Charles Dickens was pretty darn good and that he would be huge one day. And look at us now. We're talking about A Tale of Two Cities.
Let's just keep pushing him. I'm
pretty sure that we should take credit for some of his success.
The thing that's funny is, not that long after he died, everybody was making fun of his books, and it took G.K. Chesterton to write about them and say, are you kidding?
These are amazing, really?
And bring him back into fashion.
My gosh.
Yeah.
That just blows me away.
Yeah. Is this like the
Stephen King type of a, you know, he is not literary and not worth,
yeah,
really?
Yeah, that's,
I mean,
it.
That's crazy.
His characters are flat. He's, you know, and true, not all of them are, you know, bouncing off the page, but enough are. And yeah, and so many coincidences, and, you know, and I'm just like, genius. Hello.
He is. You know, when I think about this book and just the fact that it was being released in weekly installments.
Oh my gosh.
And it wasn't finished when, you know, it started being released. Right. That just blows me away. Being a person who has attempted a novel, how on earth can that be? It just blows me away.
Well, and the crazy thing is, it wasn't until he was several books in that he said, you know, I think they might go better if I planned the story arc ahead of time. And you look at some of the books, and I enjoy the books, all of them, to some degree. But you look at, of course, later he gets, you know, this is one of his last books, and so it's highly planned. But even then, like you say, he's still putting it out in installments, and a lot of the times, based on reader feedback, he would change some stuff.
No kidding.
And I'm trying to remember the specific example. I know that sometimes his friends would influence him, and that's one thing. But I'm trying to remember the book where he got all this reader feedback and went, oh, okay, well, then I'll make this person nicer. And he did.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's just something.
He loved his audience. And I read a book called Dickens and the Great Theater of the World by Simon Callow, who is an actor and also goes around doing all these, I guess they're one-person readings or presentations of pieces of Dickens. And it's a wonderfully written short biography that also will talk, of course, about the books he's doing. And if you can get the audiobook, he reads it himself. And he's got the most marvelous voice and the most wonderful way of presenting it. And so he'll talk about some of that stuff, too.
So that is something that Dickens used to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was read out loud in front of an audience?
Yes, and they loved it, and he loved them. And part of what Callow says, and this seems to be borne out by the things he would refer to, you know, that he was using people's references at the time, but Dickens loved to get the feedback because he treated the world like a theater. He kind of needed that to kind of help him keep going, you know.
Wow.
He didn't work in isolation, essentially.
Yeah, how interesting that is. You know, it's like working on the internet without the internet.
Yeah.
I don't know what kind of is. It's almost like a social network type of a situation.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, exactly.
So this is one of his later books. Is it one of his best? I know. Okay, because I had listened to a lecture that I found on YouTube, and that guy he read from a letter in which Dickens was writing to someone, and he said, "I think this may be the best thing I've written." So he thought highly of it himself, but it was terrific. I mean, in fact, as soon as I finished it, I wanted to start it over because I was just like, that was really, really great.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah. I mean, it is really dense, too. There's so much happening, so much happening that I just wanted to start over and get it all.
Well, when you consider this is one of his shorter ones, I mean, my version is 321 pages, which for Dickens is pretty short.
Right. And my version was like 480 pages, but then when I started hitting the end, I realized, oh, there's appendices. So 390.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's just page size and type size and everything
right,
else.
Right.
But it's no Bleak House. Bleak House was probably twice as long.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people will say Bleak House was his best novel or his best book, but, you know, then they'll say, but this is my favorite, you know, kind of thing. And when I first encountered Dickens as an adult, I'm sure I was made to read some of him, but I don't really remember it. And maybe A Tale of Two Cities. But it was because I'd read Uncle Tom's Cabin, and that was at my daughter Rose's urging, and said, my goodness, if I enjoyed this classic this much, what other classics might I be missing? And so I said, well, shoot, I was working on a big project that left me a lot of extra brain time, so I downloaded A Tale of Two Cities from LibriVox. And it didn't matter that it was read by a lot of different people. Some of them could hardly speak English. I got to the end of the book with the last lines, which I didn't realize were from this book. And in context, they hit me so hard that I had to stop what I was doing in my office, and I just sat there and cried.
Wow. Yeah.
And every time I read it, even though I do know all that stuff now, it still gets me. I still find myself all choked up.
Yeah. It hits you for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It is incredible. Yeah. And there was a lot of things in here that, you know, I've heard that before, you know, or, you know, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times, you know, is one of those things that, you know, you just hear all the time. And, you know, it's nice to have read it just for that even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, think about it. Isn't this the book that Mr. Spock gives Captain Kirk in The Wrath of Khan?
That's absolutely right.
And that's, now you understand the full context of, you know, what the screenwriter was going for in terms of resurrection and new life.
Yeah,
and in fact, just yesterday I was someplace where somebody had been sick and they were joining us for a conversation. And without even thinking about it, I patted her on the arm and said, recalled to life. And she said, I feel like I am, you know, because she'd been sick for so long. And I went, oh, my gosh, that's from Dickens. You know?
How about that?
Yeah. And the whole book starts off with recalled to life. You know, Mr. Laurie is going off and he's thinking over he was on his way to dig someone out of a grave. And so that, and he talks about, you know, the specter he was thinking of. And so between that and the fact that it starts off with, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was just like our times. And I thought, and isn't that how we all think today?
Yeah. Yeah. No question. No question. It feeds right into what you were saying about, you know, we're all uneasy about the state of the world today, you know, for various reasons. We're all got our sides, but you've said before, you know, well, history tells us that that's really kind of a normal state.
Yeah.
You know, it's the peaceful times that seem to be the abnormal ones, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm saying, you know, we're not always at war, although there's been a heck of a lot of that. And, but you know, as far as, you know, settled, you know, I do have to say, you know, I was born in 1968. So basically I missed the 60s, right? Mm-hmm. So all of that turmoil, especially that year, 1968, all of that turmoil was sort of settled. And really when I started to become aware was at the Carter administration into the Reagan administration.
Oh.
And so for us to have the people that I was around, you know, my generation or my group of people, for us to say that everything seemed settled forever, it definitely applies. Because we went through a time, you know, there was no war. I mean, well, the United States, there was no... you know, for what was it? The first Iraq War, the first Gulf War, was really in my lifetime, my aware lifetime, was the first war, and I was in college at that time. So, for that, my entire life, things seemed like they were settled. Right.
That's interesting because so I was born. Okay, full disclosure, everyone, I was born in 1957. But because I was a kid for most of the 60s, I didn't pay much attention to it. You know, it might be on the news or something, but my parents didn't really tend to talk about the news. It would be on, but they weren't having conversations about it around us, if so. And I would see the death count from the Vietnam War, but I wouldn't really think about it, you know, because I was a kid. You know, it's just something on TV. And so I knew things were unsettled. But it didn't touch me. My life was good.
Yeah.
And everybody I knew, we were in Kansas. It was very settled. No one was rioting around us. And I was more aware of the 70s being a time of social revolution and everything because I was in high school then and college throughout the 70s. But even then, I was in Kansas. We were settled. It was nobody I knew was taking part in that. Those were like nowadays, you know, it's the more extreme things. Oh, somebody might come home and to shock their parents, they'd say they were becoming a vegetarian and have to eat a lot of sunflower seeds and stuff for energy. But then, you know, the 80s seemed really to me like a flashback to the 50s because it was so settled. And that's the time period you're talking about.
Yeah, that's where I grew up.
And so it's really funny to me that I'll talk to my kids who are in the latter part of their 20s. And they'll be saying, oh, because of this and this. And I'm like, oh, right. I said, they're all worried about Putin and Russia. And I'm like, oh, okay. And they're like, you're not worried? I'm like, I saw the Cold War. It was always just in the background. And although it didn't affect me and I didn't worry about it because I wasn't in Miami or wherever everybody was worried about Cuba bombing them or whatever, I'm like, I always knew it was there. I always figured we'd win because we're the best. But I'm now providing a lot of that context. I'm like, oh, I'm like the old grandma on the porch or something, though I'm not that old, everyone. But just saying, oh, this cycle has happened in my lifetime. We've seen somebody like him rise. The people over the weekend were talking about the Korean or the North Koreans have satellites up. And I'm like, oh, they do. Aren't you upset? I'm like, that's the Russians had all that before. Why do you think Reagan wanted to do Star Wars? I'm like, I can't worry about that. It's always there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's so funny to see those cycles kind of come around again. Like, and it happens for all kinds of things. So like the social upheaval of, you know, the vegans. And so that's like the vegetarians. You come home and you upset everyone because now I'm vegan. I'm seeing parents with college age kids. So-and-so came home and he's vegan now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, no so question. That's a long way to go from the best of times to the worst of times. Yeah, but it totally is.
And then here we are looking at, so it was the year of our Lord, 1775. Man, a lot was going on right then, eh?
I know. I was like, oh my gosh.
You know,
revolution.
Imagine living at that time, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, not if you're in France, you know, the revolution is not far away. And if you're in England, you've got some noisy neighbors across the ocean that are causing a lot of trouble.
Yeah, who you can't stand anyway.
Right, right. Pretty much. So, but yeah, what an amazing time.
Well, and Dickens wrote two books about revolution or historical fiction. Both of them had to do with revolution. Barnaby Rudge was an early one. And that was about, and I wasn't aware of these till I read the book, the anti-Catholic riots that went on for several days, I think maybe three nights.
Really?
And I mean, they were going around burning people's houses down and stuff in London. They were calling in the militia and the soldiers from everywhere to put it down because the mobs were so huge.
Wow. Yeah.
And I was unaware of it. And I enjoyed that book. It's not as skilled and not making the same points that this book is making. And it's from his earlier time period. And you can tell. But it has interesting things to say also. And this one, I think, I love the personal story in it. But also to me, what comes across really clearly is he's comparing England to France. You know, you have the mob in England. And they act very differently than the mob in France, where the mob in England that we see, it's like pretty soon the rumor went around that the watch was coming. Nobody knows if that was true, but they all kind of melted away. That's the way of a mob. And in France, of course, they'd overthrown all that. No one from the watch dared to come near or stop them.
That's right. And, that's right.
Yeah. And then you also have the idea that he didn't approve of oppression at all, as we know, but he really also didn't approve of revolution as a way to settle it.
Yeah, yeah.
He's pretty disapproving of all those French people in turn, based on their behavior in this book.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, so the two cities in question, right, are London and Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so the novel takes place, was it about a 20-year period or so?
Yeah.
1775, and then the French Revolution is 1789.
Okay.
And, you know, so it jumps around.
Yeah,
something like that. But yeah, so events happen, and then it moves forward in time, and then there's more stuff, and then it moves forward in time, and then there's a flashback.
All the best books have flashbacks.
That's right. That's right.
Well, yeah, because it's essentially a story in three parts, which is one is there's and it revolves around a young girl or young woman and her father and the people who are connected with them, although that's not obvious from the very beginning. So at the beginning of the book, it's they're trying to get the father, who Dr. Manette, who has been imprisoned for a very long time. He's been released from prison, and they're bringing him home. And the middle of the book is what life is like in England as they try to help him get his bearings, and what's happening in the household, the people who come and go, some of whom we met at the beginning, some of whom we meet there. And then at the end, the French Revolution has happened. And unbeknownst to us, somebody is intimately involved with the French Revolution, and not in an instigating way, but just through an accident of birth and everything else, they get drawn into it. And then the family's efforts and friends' efforts go to trying to get this person out of that revolution safely.
Mm-hmm.
And all the themes that are in there, of course, because we're told the story personally, are these big themes of, you know, love, forgiveness, revenge. I mean, they're big themes. And it's interesting to see them carried out in this family, in their intentions and their experiences, as well as on the historical scene. I mean, because some of the stuff, especially in France, where he's showing you the horrible oppression of the landed people or the lords, and then he's showing you the mob later, you know, you feel, or at least I did, genuine anxiety and upset over these, everybody's inhumanity.
Yeah, I did. I felt the same way. And, you know, like you're saying, there was this personal thing and this epic thing. You know, when you get to the mobs and when things are really moving sort of in a macro way, you know, the revolution is really happening. Those were incredible chapters.
Oh my gosh.
Really just, you know, absolutely everything's well written, of course, you know, you just want to highlight the whole thing. But it was striking to me how you had these scenes that were epic, and that's the only word I can think of is they were epic in the scope, but yet the story was super personal at the same time. And he didn't stay in the epic mode for very long at any point in time, but it was amazing, you know, and it kind of gives you the feeling of inevitability, as if, you know, I know he compared it to an ocean where there's just this wave, and the mob is just following in this wave and imagining being caught up in that, and there's nothing that you can do. And it does feel like despair and anxiety, like you were saying. You know, how could you not respond to that? You know, you're going to be swept up in it.
Yeah. Well, so. And he, because it's a tale of two cities, and we talked about this in Bleak House also some, is, you know, he's a master at showing us doubles of things to compare and contrast. Mm-hmm. And I would say the two cities are also Sidney Carton and Charles Darnay, Lucy versus Madame Defarge. You know, is to show us all the different attitudes and responses to having loved ones treated in a certain way or being in the middle of the action, and how do you carry out your intentions. It's an old story, but we need to get into specifics.
Yeah, I think so. If you don't want to be spoiled, by all means, go read it. But feel free to be spoiled and then go read it on this one, I would say.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And there are plot twists. You would be surprised. Even I, reading this is my third time to read it, I guess. And I was surprised by some of the stuff that I hadn't remembered.
Yeah.
Mostly minor things like Jerry Cruncher at the end going, I hope my old woman's flopping down right now. And Miss Cross is going, what? You know, hoping she's praying for us, essentially, is what he's saying.
Yeah, you said Charles Darnay. And for some reason, it just struck me that his initials are CD. Is there anything to be made of that?
Oh, I don't
Charles
know.
Dickens? I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know either. It just occurred to me. I don't know if there's any kind of himself there where, you know.
Yeah, he's one of the more colorless characters, I would say, because he's kind of there just to provide the example of how the British treat a trial for treason and to give Lucy a love interest. And he's so physically identical to Sidney Carton, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And he provides the foil to Sidney Carton, who says, I'm also in love with Lucy. I realize I've wasted my whole life and I didn't care until now when I have something worth living for and that I want to try to win. I am not the person who's worthy of this prize that would be this woman's love. And also he pushes the plot forward in his connections, because he's just good. You know, like there's one point where Dickens is talking about coming to England, and he's kind of making a point about immigrants in a sense. And he says, with great perseverance and untiring industry, he prospered. In London, he had expected neither to walk on pavements of gold nor to lie on beds of roses. If he had had any such exalted expectation, he would not have prospered. He had expected labor, and he found it, and did it, and made the best of it. In this, his prosperity consisted. And I think that's something that, you know, they got tons of French refugees from before, especially from during the French Revolution. That's one of the things the revolutionaries are so mad about. Oh, you're an emigre. You ran away. We know you're against us.
Yeah.
So he's kind of there to be the prototypical good guy, you know?
Yeah, you're talking about Darnay?
Yeah, Charles Darnay.
Okay,
right?
Okay, for a second, I just got confused about Darnay and Carton.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
so I'm sorry. Darnay is... Maybe I switched back without meaning to. Sorry.
No, don't be sorry. But yeah, so I agree with that. But yeah, he is super important. You know, he's also the one who has really abdicated all of his riches, right?
Mm-hmm.
And said, you know, I'm leaving. So right. There is that, you know, that was one response. Like you said, you know, if she's, or if Dickens is sort of collecting responses or showing all the various responses to this revolutionary situation, that was one of them, is to basically say, you know what? My family is rich because of the people, or on the backs of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to leave because I don't want any of this inheritance or anything like that. And off he ran.
Well, and his mother had, you know, it's even more pointed when you realize the backstory, and that his mother was part of that really horrible family that took advantage of everyone and didn't thought of people as the peasants, as animals, essentially. And his mother had made him promise never to do that.
Wow. Yeah.
That, you know, and he was the person that Madame Defarge is going after, because she's going to get everybody from that family, every descendant.
Mm-hmm.
But she's just as bad as the royalty in her own way, because she's showing no mercy either.
Wow. And I mean, that rings so true as well. I mean, it's, you know, there seems to be, you know, in our experience, in our current times, you know, there's this, the sides responding to each other, you know, it just seems to ratchet up and up and up. And then you always get to a point of almost ridiculousness in the support or defense of a position, you know, really as a response to somebody else who, you know, they think is just as ridiculous. But the Marquis, that scene where the Marquis is zipping through town in the carriage and he kills a kid because he hits him and then throws a coin out, says, here, this should take care of it.
Yeah.
That was something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, cause it makes you, kind of realize it almost justifies the revolution. In a scene, he's basically saying, yeah, this is how they were treating each other.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see that, again, inevitability, I guess, is a word that comes to mind.
Yeah, and you feel nothing but sympathy for the peasants, and the Defarges have always seemed like really decent people. They helped get Dr. Manet away, and, you know, they're operating their spy network to kind of help foster the revolution, but they don't seem... I don't know. They don't seem vindictive. And then what you find out is, oh, well, Monsieur Darnay, or not Darnay, I'm sorry, Defarge, is more reasonable as the revolution's going on. He's like, well, do we need to get everybody from the Darnay family? What are the little kids, surely, you know, little, I can't remember what her name is, daughter.
Yeah, Lucy was her name too, I think.
Oh, did they name her Lucy?
I think so, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so little Lucy. And, and the wife's like, no, that's it. They did this to my sister so long ago, which that was the twist. I didn't remember why Madame Defarge was so merciless. I was like, oh, I forgot. She goes back to that long story. It's all connected. And but she was like, nope, they have to be wiped out to the last person.
Hmm.
And that's why she goes running off, because she knows her husband will come back and try to stop her, although he's very weak.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm going to go off and I'm going to get them now before they get out of town.
Right.
The end.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and he did. I loved this book because Dickens did so much with foreshadowing. And when you're reading it for the first time, you don't realize it. But as you're going through it again, you're realizing things like, and some of it's obvious, of course, like the broken wine cask that foreshadows the blood that's going to be spilled in the streets. And the peasants are all going out and sopping up the wine in, you know, anything they can and dripping it into their mouths. And one guy even writes blood on the wall with the wine. And you're like, yep, that's the foreshadowing of what's going to come. Or with Mr. Lorry at the beginning, his meditations on getting Dr. Manet out of Paris. And he's thinking, okay, recalled to life, you know, 18 years in prison. He's thinking over that story just very tangentially so that we don't know what's going on until later. But that, of course, is foreshadowing all the resurrection themes that are coming up toward the end of the book, where we see what's going to happen so that Charles Darnay can be freed from prison, snuck out of prison.
Mm-hmm. That still just blows me away. I mean, Sidney Carton is a very interesting character.
Isn't he? Because he's not likable.
No, he's not. It's, you know, this is one of the reasons why I want to read this book again. You know, and this foreshadowing that you're talking about, which is amazing because, he was writing it on the fly.
Right.
So it's like, you know, foreshadowing on the fly is just, I don't know. The guy is a genius.
Well, and even like one of his more comic characters, Jerry Cruncher, who runs errands for the bank, Mr. Lorry's bank, during the day. But at night, he sneaks off and he's what they call a resurrection man, which is he's a grave robber.
Yeah.
For extra money.
Right. So he digs up bodies and sells them to scientists.
Right. And so he's, he's giving them so to call new life. He's called a resurrection man. And the continual struggle for him is with his wife, who knows what he's doing, and she doesn't stop him, but she prays about it all the time. And he's like, quit flopping down, old woman. You know, don't want the bread on the table. Don't want the, you know, this is what I'm earning for you, essentially.
Right, right.
And at the end, of course, he's like, oh, I hope she's praying now. We're never going to get out of this revolution alive. And but the fact that he's a resurrection man, I mean, that word is used everywhere and that imagery is used a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, Sidney Carton is looking at his own reflection. And he's talking about Charles Darnay because he knows that Lucy loves Charles, but she doesn't love him. And he says, do you particularly like the man? He muttered at his own image. Why should you particularly like a man who resembles you? There is nothing in you to like. You know that. Oh, confound you. What a change you've made in yourself. And he goes on and he says, change places with him. And would you have been looked at by those blue eyes as he was and commiserated by that agitated face as he was? Come on and have it out in plain words. You hate the fellow. But of course, at the end, he has changed places with him. And Lucy and her whole family remember and praise him for, you know, as long as they go on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, wow, it's just an incredible thing that he did, you know, and he really didn't do it for, what's his name? Charles. Yeah. Darnay. he really didn't do it for him. He did it for Lucy. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's the one who can go in both those worlds where he's kind of going undercover in Paris, you know, and, you know, he kind of comes up and I went, oh, I forgot he was there. I knew he had to get there somehow.
Yeah. 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 But, and you're right. He did have all the connections too, where, you know, to get into the prison and everything, he, you know, drags some people with him, says, no, you're coming with me. So
who we met at the beginning. In fact, it was a good thing Dickens reminded us, as he would have had to do serially.
Mm-hmm.
They say that's why he made some characters so really memorable, was so that people would pick it up and go, oh, it's that guy.
Hmm.
You know, if you haven't seen him for months and months.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder how many weeks this took. How many?
I bet it's, try Wikipedia.
Yeah, I'm just curious. And the lecture that I listened to also said that the United States was doing it too at the same time. The day after it published in London, because his letter said something like they were giving him £1,000 a year. Harper's.
Magazine.
Yeah. So they, so it was being published in the United States at the same time.
Oh, yeah. Well, because remember, that's the famous story about the old curiosity shop, which was way before this. And people were at the docks as the boats would come in going, did little Nell die? What happened to little Nell? Because they'd gotten it first.
My gosh.
The new installments were coming over on the boat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So didn't he also go on an American tour to read out loud to audiences?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yes. It was a point of contention because he loved America. He just thought America was the greatest place ever. And then he got over here and went, oh, it's full of real people who aren't really perfect. And, oh, they've got this slavery thing that they're all embracing, you know, once he got to the South. And he then saw some of the crude things of, in many ways, it was, you know, the, what would you say, the pioneer country still. And so when he wrote, Martin Chuzzlewit. In the middle of the book, Martin emigrates to America. And it is the making of Martin. Martin badly needs it. But America is portrayed on one flat note, and it is the most unflattering note you can possibly imagine. Really? And I was listening to the audiobook, and I finally went, I get it, but this is not entertaining, enlightening, or amusing. I'm sorry that you hate us so much. I understand why. These people are awful. But I got the print book so I could kind of skim over some of that stuff. I was like, okay, moving on, you know.
Wow, okay. And that's really the only stuff he wrote about America?
No, he wrote, I think he wrote a book about going there. He wrote letters back that were published.
Oh, so like a nonfiction thing.
Yeah, oh okay. Yeah, he would write nonfiction stuff.
Gotcha.
He had, I think, one called Pictures from Italy, and he had The Uncommercial Traveler, which was essays or something. Anyway, so he wrote other stuff, but
right.
Mostly he wrote fiction. Mm-hmm. But he did, you know, everything. He had so much energy. anyway,
he does seem like he was energetic.
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to mention is Dr. Manette is a very interesting character because for most of the book, he is very shadowy and insubstantial. He's been released from prison. He's clearly mentally unbalanced. And because he was in solitary confinement most of the time, I mean, and what he had to do to hang on to any sanity was make shoes once they gave him a shoemaking kit. So he reverts to that a lot. And he gradually, because his daughter, who he didn't even know existed, he was torn away from his pregnant wife. He didn't know if his wife was alive. He didn't know if the child had been born alive. So he was tortured by this the whole time. His daughter was alive, and she devoted herself to him. And through her kind care and love, he started to come back to himself. But he was always, you know, kind of, what would you say, non-substantial?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it was
ethereal, yeah.
Right, ethereal. Yeah, kind of like a ghost. And at the end of the book, though, when he suddenly realizes, because everybody in Paris knows he was a prisoner of the aristocracy for 18 years for something that wasn't his fault, like most of them. They don't know exactly why, but they just know he was in prison. So he's a hero to the revolutionaries. And because of that, when Lucy's husband is imprisoned and they go over there to try and get him out, Dr. Manet can go anywhere and he'll take care of anyone because he is still a practicing physician. And so he makes himself extra beloved to everyone. And so he's going and getting information. He's dropping a word of influence here and there to try and get the trial moved up. And I was really struck by the idea that his ability to forgive and forget and not try to bring his own cause to the fore, you know, when he's in Paris, he's just working for Charles's release so that he can bring happiness to his daughter and to her family. And that, and the fact that his suffering now means something. Suddenly he's a much more realized person. He's active. He's effective. He's reassuring Lucy. He's strong. And it says, for the first time, the doctor felt now that his suffering was strength and power. For the first time, he felt that in that sharp fire, he had slowly forged the iron which could break the prison door of his daughter's husband and deliver him. Quote, it all tended to a good end, my friend. He's talking to Mr. Lorry, I think. It was not mere waste and ruin. As my beloved child was helpful in restoring me to myself, I will be helpful now in restoring the dearest part of herself to her. By the aid of heaven, I will do it. Thus, Dr. Manette. And when Jarvis Lorry saw the kindled eyes, the resolute face, the calm, strong look and bearing of the man whose life always seemed to him to have been stopped like a clock for so many years and then set going again with an energy which had lain dormant during the cessation of its usefulness, he believed. And I thought, well, that goes along so well with the Catholic understanding of offering up your suffering alongside Christ's. For others.
Yeah, good point.
Mm-hmm. When you believe it has meaning, you become not a victim.
Right, right. Yes, absolutely. And then Yeah, I love that thought. I love that thought. I don't want to leave that without considering that. So he does manage to get Darnay freed, right, through all that stuff. And then immediately he's arrested again.
I know. It's just
like, it's like on the way home he got arrested again.
Yeah, I think he was home for an hour or two. And then
it's crazy. And then that was infuriating. And then that was when, you know, like you were saying before, when you realized, I don't know that they've done a revolution, but now are they any better? You know, it's like,
right,
you know, they're not, right. And they're basically saying, the Marquis is a bad guy. And not only that, but they're using Manet's words, right? Manet's actual words. But they were saying, you know, yeah, the Marquis, therefore the family of the Marquis, who the Marquis himself has died a long time ago.
Right.
But they're saying Darnay, because he is related, needs to pay the price.
Right. It's that unthinking crowd, that unthinking mob.
Right.
Where they just accept the sound bites, so to speak, of people. Yeah. And that's so brilliant in showing how fickle they are, I guess.
Yeah.
Day he's a hero.
Yeah.
And then the next day he's...
Well, it's pretty much the same day.
Yeah. Well, in trial. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Day.
Well, and for Dr. Manet, it's kind of interesting because it's a backwards look. When his words are used to condemn Charles Darnay, it's his own desire for revenge.
Right.
That's why he wrote that paper down and hid it that brought destruction.
Mm.
So Charles Dickens is using the same person to show, look, forgiveness and using your suffering for a positive note is what will bring hope and help to everybody and to yourself, and strength. But revenge is what will tear it down just as easily.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, that's really terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I remember when I was reading that, you know, that was no better than the Marquis running a kid over and throwing a coin out. You know,
right.
How is this better? They're just going to run Darnay over, you know, with the guillotine, which is also some profound writing there. I mean, the whole last.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just amazing.
Well, yeah, because Madame Defarge, of course, she's doubled up against Lucy, who just wants to try to help the people she loves.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a family member who was hurt terribly and lost her mother and all this stuff because of the aristocracy's actions. And Lucy's kind of a cipher also. I mean, she's just good and sweet and all this stuff. And she believes in Sydney because she saw a little deeper, but she's not given the force of personality that Madame Defarge is with her implacable knitting and her notes that she knits into her work. But Madame Defarge has also had a family member greatly wronged, or two family members greatly wronged. And she takes it and forges it into this iron blade, essentially, that she's going to stab in the heart of everyone who's at all related to it.
Wow. Yeah.
But she's also kind of opposite to Dr. Manet for the same reason, you know, or the aristocracy, as you're pointing out. I'm sorry. She's the same as them.
Right. Right.
Yeah, which is why it's so brilliant when I loved that fight between her and Miss Pross.
Mm.
The old nurse who's like, you know, you're not going to find out that my darling has left. She's going to buy him all the time she can to get past the barriers and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they're going to fight, and it's Madame Defarge's own desire for violence and destruction that kills her because she's killed by her own bullet.
Right. Again, wow. Yeah. Yeah, this is really opening a lot of things up, but you're right. She's killed by her own bullet. Yeah.
Yeah, well, true disclosure, I did look up a few things. I wish I'd seen all this myself.
No, but that's just great, you know, because it's not unlike what happened to Dr. Manet, right?
Right.
It's like Dr. Manet's own revenge bullet, I guess. You know, that took down Darnay. Just amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to go off. That desire for revenge is going to be twisted. And I think what he's pointing out is there's a place for justice, but there's a place for mercy. And Dickens is always on the side of justice, but justice necessarily carries you have to be open to mercy. You know, what are the degrees of someone's sin? I mean, just being born into a family is not enough to require that you die. But to Madame Defarge, they're all painted with one brush.
Yeah.
You know, she's not going to look at any details. And that's the kind of thing that I think we're seeing today. That's why we say it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. And I'm talking about the extreme right and the extreme left especially.
Yeah.
It's funny because I'll see people, my husband, I think I've said this before on Facebook, anybody who wants to friend him, he friends, and he rarely comments, but he will read what everybody's linking to and he'll just laugh because his own family in different parts of his own family, people will be putting up the most conservative stuff and the other people, the most progressive stuff. And he's like, they're exactly mirror images, just putting in different names, but it's the same level of hatred and disdain and a lack of, you know, trying to see anybody else's point of view. And we were just in a family gathering recently and we came away going, oh, okay, this happened to be a super conservative side, but and we came away going, wow, we always think of ourselves as middle of the road, more leaning to the conservative. And I'm like, boy, I really realize it now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm having similar experiences. With that stuff too. It is something how, you know, I like the point about, you know, just switching the names, you know, because it does seem, you know, like over the last 8 years, you know, both sides had these things that were non-negotiable and now they've taken the opposite sides because of who's in charge. So it's just like, wow, it just makes you want to throw your hands in the air. But isn't that what's happening in this novel? You know, it is exactly. We want those fierce people out of power.
Yeah.
But then we're going to be fierce too, you know, which is kind of what happened.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's the extremes. And the funny thing to me is in this book, each side of extremes can't see when they're on top what the other people are upset about or even care.
Right.
And then it's flipped, of course, and they're the ones who are cringing and running and hoping for mercy and all this kind of thing. And all the innocents around them are being swept into it, both sides, each way. And the people in our country can't see the same thing either. You know, you try to reason with them. And I've tried to reason with both sides and just gone, okay, you clearly can't even hear me.
Yeah. So then, you know, now you've got Sidney Carton. Who's sort of walking, even though he's like deeply connected, it seems like he's untouched by it.
He doesn't care about anyone.
He doesn't care about it. Lucy. Right. So, yeah. And then, you were talking about, I was hoping that you'd read that part, where he's, by the ocean, I believe, contemplating.
He knows what he's going to do to save Charles Darnay, and he set it up. It's in motion. And did you suspect when you were reading it, or did you already know what
he was planning? No, I didn't already know, but yeah, I did suspect. I kind of felt like something was going to happen. I didn't know for sure about the sacrifice. I guess I thought he was going to break him out.
And that's how I remember feeling when I read it. Right.
And then, you know, I think the part you're about to read is where I started to realize something.
And this is when he's set everything up and he says, there's nothing I can do till tomorrow, but I can't sleep. And so he goes out walking. This is a bit lengthy, but and please indulge me.
Yes, please do.
It says, long ago, when he had been famous among his earliest competitors as a youth of great promise, and that promise was all wasted, which that's my comment. He had followed his father to the grave. His mother had died years before. These solemn words, which had been read at his father's grave, arose in his mind as he went down the dark streets among the heavy shadows, with the moon and the clouds sailing on high above him. I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live, and whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. In a city dominated by the axe, alone at night, with natural sorrow rising in him for the 63 who had been that day put to death, and for tomorrow's victims then awaiting their dooms in the prisons, and still of tomorrows and tomorrows, the chain of association that brought the words home, like a rusty old ship's anchor from the deep, might have been easily found. He did not seek it, but repeated them and went on. And then I'm going to skip ahead because he's walking through the streets and encountering various people. Now that the streets were quiet and the night wore on, the words were in the echoes of his feet and were in the air, perfectly calm and steady. He sometimes repeated them to himself as he walked, but he heard them always. The night wore out, and as he stood upon the bridge, listening to the water as it splashed the river walls of the island of Paris, where the picturesque confusion of houses and cathedrals shone bright in the light of the moon, the day came coldly, looking like a dead face out of the sky. Then the night, with the moon and stars, turned pale and died, and for a little while it seemed as if creation were delivered over to death's dominion. But the glorious sun, rising, seemed to strike those words, that burden of night, straight and warm to his heart in its long bright rays. And looking along them with reverently shaded eyes, a bridge of light appeared to span the air between him and the sun while the river sparkled under it. The strong tide, so swift, so deep and certain, was like a congenial friend in the morning stillness. He walked by the stream, far from the houses, and in the light and warmth of the sun, fell asleep on the bank. When he awoke and was afoot again, he lingered there yet a little longer, watching an eddy that turned and turned purposeless, until the stream absorbed it and carried it on to the sea. Like me, a trading boat with a sail of the softened color of a dead leaf, then glided into his view, floated by him, and died away. As its silent track in the water disappeared, the prayer that had broken up out of his heart for a merciful consideration of all his poor blindnesses and errors ended in the words, I am the resurrection and the life.
Wow.
Beautiful. And you can see it got to me again.
Yes. So beautiful.
And you know what I didn't notice until I was reading it out loud? At this point, he says the words were in the echoes of his feet. And remember the part earlier where they talked about the house being in London, being in a little corner where you'd hear all the footsteps from the streets nearby. And at one point there's a big thunderstorm and they're watching the lightning and hearing the steps. And Sidney Carton says something about, I hear all those steps. They're all coming for us.
Wow.
They mean something.
Yeah.
I don't know what. And I was like, dang.
Wow.
Dickens.
Yeah. And one of the things I was thinking of as you were reading it, you know, so he's looking at water, you know, and he's looking at that, you know, and earlier, and I've got it in front of me, you know, with this was during a scene where it was showing the revolution. Mm-hmm. It says, with a roar that sounded as if all breath in France had been shaped into the detested word, the living sea rose, wave on wave, depth on depth, and overflowed the city to that point. So there is, you know, kind of a metaphor of this inevitability. Again, I'm using that word, but the whole, just this, the sea of the mob, you know, and he's likening it to a sea of great power with a roar, right? And then here you're showing it, it's peaceful, and he's watching the leaf go by.
Like
that's
me.
It's a contrast, yeah.
Yeah, the little leaf that he, it stands out. And yeah, that's interesting that you keep using the word inevitable. And you know, the history, the tide of events is inevitable. We can't stop that big tide, but that one little leaf can do what it does.
Right, right.
And that's Sydney. And it makes me think, you talking about that water, there's another water image used for Madame Defarge. Oh. Where she goes to see Miss Pross. She's standing up. Miss Pross is washing her face. And she looks up and there's somebody standing there. The basin fell to the ground broken, and the water flowed to the feet of Madame Defarge. By strange, stern ways and through much straining blood, those feet had come to meet that water.
Wow.
So she also has that choice to make, like Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are you going to do? The resurrection and the life means nothing to her.
Yeah.
I remember the last time I read this book, the second time, so I'd already, you know, absorbed the main story, and this is when you catch some of the other stuff. That's when I was like, how did I miss all this strongly worded symbolism about the resurrection that Sydney's going through? This is his hope.
Hmm.
Because by now he's set on his path. He's not even thinking he'll ever give it up. He's doing it for Lucy. It's that sacrifice that true love calls forth. We sacrifice anything for the ones we love.
Yeah.
And I think of at my daughter Hannah and Mark's wedding, there was a wise old priest. And one of the things he said was, we look for somebody these days who will make us happy, but that's not the meaning of marriage. The meaning of marriage should be, who's the one I love so much I would sacrifice everything for?
Hmm.
And that's, this whole book is about that. True love inspires sacrifice. But that sacrifice, you can change up to the very end. Sydney Carton is changed by his love for Lucy so that he does something, as he says at the end, that is great.
Yeah, yeah.
And on the way, the thing I find so touching is he's doing it for Lucy. But he's also there, in that case, to comfort the poor little seamstress who's caught up in it because she was earning her living by sewing for the rich people.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's there with her to the end.
That was difficult. Yeah.
I'm crying right now, everybody. Yeah. I'm sorry. It's just, or maybe I'm not sorry. If you're not moved by this, you don't have a heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. What a book.
Yeah.
Kind of speechless. It's like, you know, what do you say after all that? There's so much here, like we said at the beginning, and so much intertwined things. Like, I'm definitely going to read it again. You know, I need to have a year of Dickens like you do. I love when you select, you know, you say, oh, this year I'm going to read a bunch of this, you know, and
yeah,
that's cool. That is, yeah. That's neat.
I was recently thinking I want to read some more Dickens, but I can't pick anything. And I was like, maybe this time I'll read them in order.
Ooh, cool. What's first?
Well, I've never read Sketches by Boz, and I don't really want to. That was written for the newspaper, you know. Mm. And some are little stories, and some are just sketches of people. So the Pickwick Papers would be first. And I, unlike a lot of people, I like the Pickwick Papers. I mean, especially once you get to chapter 10 where Sam Weller comes in and he becomes Pancho Sanza.
Sancho Panza.
Sancho Panza.
Don Quixote, really, you mean?
Me. Yes, yeah. To Mr. Pickwick's Don Quixote. And it's funny because adding him is when the sales picked up, but it's also when I think Dickens started to kind of find himself as telling a longer story because Mr. Pickwick becomes less a figure of fun and more of somebody you can follow and admire.
Wow.
Too. But in this book, I would say this is one of those books that I got done reading it this time again, and I couldn't read anything for a while. Because the beauty of what I'd read and the depth of what I'd read and just even the way it was written, everything else was really shallow next to it.
Yeah, yeah. I've had that feeling too. Mm-hmm. Yep. I had that feeling with Steinbeck as well, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, there are different authors I feel that way with. The Lord of the Rings, after I read it, will be that way. And, you know, different books like that.
For sure.
Just like, I don't know if I want to read it again, but this might be the only thing I can read right now because everything else is nothing next to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep, he's going to be famous, like we said. It's going to be big.
Well, so if you had to sum it up for somebody.
Sum up the book?
Give it away, knowing that most people don't really know the twist like they would have about 40 or 50 years ago.
Yeah.
From movies and stuff. What would you say?
Wow. I mean, on the surface, this is a story about the French Revolution and the people that are caught up in it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And, but I would say, you know, it is the personal story. So, yeah, it's about love and sacrifice.
Yeah.
Like you said. And, I guess that's how I would describe it. I don't know how much time I'd have with a person say, all right, we'll sit down. It's 1775.
I really want you to read this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would highly recommend it to everybody because, yeah, this is another one of those that I'm just so happy that I've read. It's great. And I will be hitting it again.
Yeah. It's that problem of it's a classic for a reason, but no one wants to read it because it's a classic and therefore it's thought to be boring.
Yeah. I don't know why. Classics are classics for reasons, right?
Yeah, I think it's because they're forced on people too early when they're in school.
That's probably true, yeah.
And you just don't have the depth to appreciate it at that point.
Yeah, if one thing, you know, that the Harry Potter phenomenon has should have showed educators is that, hey, you know, let's get them reading interesting stuff to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you build a reading habit, then you can start to get into this other thing. So I agree with you.
Yeah, and maybe it's that, you know, it's because it's either this, I think, or Oliver Twist that people are assigned when they're in school because they're short enough and simple enough to talk about. And Oliver Twist is not a favorite of mine at all, but it's something that people could understand. But on the other hand, it's not something that you can really fully understand till you're older. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Yeah, you've got to read something that's higher level or you don't even understand what higher level has. I don't know what the answer is. Like you say, Harry Potter is higher level, but are you going to go through all 7 books with the kids?
Yeah, yeah.
You have to find some compromise somehow.
Yep. You bet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so very much for picking this book. And I have a book to pick. My gosh.
Yay,
it keeps sneaking up on me where I'm like, oh no, I've got to do this.
Unlike me, who's always going, oh, what should I pick for December? Oh, it's only June. Just wait. Maybe something will strike you by then.
Hang tight. Yeah, that's too funny. All right. Yeah. So, but next we have a movie.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. What's the movie? Monsoon Wedding.
Monsoon Wedding.
Cool. And I have not seen that. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Good.
This is a tale of love.
Oh, excellent.
Definitely. It's about two Indian middle-class families in India who are getting together for an arranged wedding. And it's about a lot of the people in one of the families.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Well, all right.
Hope you like it.
I'm sure I will. Hey, that was a far, far better podcast we did than we have ever done.
Oh, yes. And it's a far, far better rest we go to than we have ever known. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.